From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, two baseball Hall of Famers, slugger Reggie Jackson and pitcher Bob Gibson, take us inside the time-honored confrontation between hitter and pitcher. We'll hear how to recognize a fastball, a slider, or a curve in less than half a second, and on the other hand, how to keep hitters guessing and swinging at thin air when you deliver a pitch. Also, we consider the life of the most abused and unpopular figure in baseball, the ump. Writer Bruce Weber attended umpire school, officiated games, and interviewed dozens of umps for his book about umpires. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Date Night, the new comedy starring Tina Fey and Steve Carell. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Few confrontations in sports are as dramatic and personal as a batter standing in against a pitcher with a baseball game on the line. The batter adjusts his helmet, tightens his gloves, digs into the batter's box, and looks toward the mound. The pitcher fingers a rosin bag, then drops it, stares at his catcher for a sign, then grips the ball and begins his windup. If his pitch is a major league fastball, it will reach the plate in less than half a second. The strategies, emotions, and sometimes explosive confrontations that arise from that duel are at the heart of a book by two legends of Major League Baseball, Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson. Jackson was a home run hitter who won 5 World Series rings with Oakland and New York and earned the nickname Mr. October for his postseason heroics. Gibson was one of the most intimidating pitchers who ever took the mound, an 8-time All-Star who won 2 championships with the St. Louis Cardinals. Both were extraordinary performers in the World Series, and both are in baseball's Hall of Fame. Their book is based on a series of recorded conversations with writer Lonnie Wheeler. It takes its name from the distance between the pitcher's mound and home plate. It's called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. I spoke with Gibson and Jackson last fall when the book was published. Well, Reggie Jackson, Bob Gibson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Bob Gibson, you say in this book that if you were a pitcher today, there are a lot more coaches and trainers and video analysis, and they would get you to try and change your windup and make it more economical, fewer moving parts. You had a lot of movement in your windup. Was that conscious?
Well, it was the way I learned to pitch. And my idea, it wasn't just my idea. I think back in the days and even before I pitched, guys would wind up, and they would go through all types of gyrations, and the hitter pretty much had to look for the ball. Where is it going to come from? And I think the more that he has to look for, the better off you are. They start pitching with no wind up and as little movement as possible, and more guys start hitting the ball 550 feet. I think that the hitter needs to look and try to figure out where that ball is coming from.
You write in the book, and this book is a collection of conversations with you guys, and at one point you say, I had a violent delivery. I wanted to be a gathering storm and blow that fastball in there with all the force and fury I could muster. Was that Bob Gibson? He just really being an intimidating force out there with that windup?
Well, yeah, kind of, except I had just more than a fastball. And I think what made me such a good pitcher
right.
was that my slider was just as good as my fastball. And I had just as good a control with my slider as a fastball. And what makes you really effective is that you get guys up there looking for a 95, 97 mile an hour fastball, and you throw them a slider that's 89 and 90. And I think that's why I did so well in the series, because those guys were looking for all fastballs.
And coming out of that all that different motion, they're worried about the speed, and then suddenly the ball's curving, it's dipping, it's off speed.
Oh, yeah, they're looking for the ball off of me. You know, what the hitter likes to do is to see where that point of release is coming from. And I think it's more difficult if your arms are waving and flapping, and not that everybody can do that. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. But I think the more he has to look for, the better off you are.
Reggie Jackson, would you be bothered by a pitcher's windup if there was a lot of motion there?
You try not to. I know that I liked it when a guy had almost a pitching motion of a catcher, just kind of a nice, easy throw, not too much movement. It made it a lot easier to follow. But following a Gibson, following a Tion, a Juan Marichal, a Warren Spahn, a Vida Blue, Jim Palmer, guys with big high kicks like Steve Carlton, it makes it tougher. Nolan Ryan had a big kick. Bert Blyleven had a big kick. And when these guys had all that going on and then threw in the high 90s to go along with it with a 12-6 breaking ball, it made it an awful lot tougher, I thought.
You guys were both in the Hall of Fame because you were great players in the regular season, but you really, really stood out in championship games when it was all on the line. You both were incredible performers in the World Series. Reggie Jackson, nobody else in the game has hit 4 homers on 4 consecutive swings in the World Series like you did in 1977. You have 5 World Series championships. What were those big games like for you? Did it feel different? Was your focus different?
It was a battle between me and the guy on the mound, and I knew everything about who I was facing, even in the other league. We had scouting reports. I paid attention to them. I watched. I learned. I understood. I felt prepared. And I really wanted a guy that I was facing to be at his best, because then it made the thinking easy, because he understood what a guy had, which was his best pitcher, say, like facing a guy like Bob Gibson in a World Series. Be proud of what you got, because then I know what I'm going to get. I may not be able to handle it, but the thinking gets simple. Mm-hmm. He's not going around me unless the situation calls for it, meaning pitch around me and face another hitter, depending on the score of the situation. I felt I was going to have a good swing. I felt prepared. So the game got a little more simple. I didn't have any clutter in my mind. It's me and you. Uh-huh. I'm ready and so are you. I hope you had a good night's rest. I hope you had a big breakfast. Kiss your wife and your baby goodbye. Get your insurance paid up.
Because here it
comes.
Grab
that can over there before you come in here.
Well, he's right about that, because when we got into the series, he was going to get what I had unless there was a situation where I needed to pitch around him. And
that meaning walk him and face the next guy, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Reggie's up there, and Reggie's not going to get a hit every time he's up there, nor is he going to hit a home run every time he's up there. But he's probably more capable of hitting one than the guy behind him. So why do a silly thing, especially if you're in a situation where he could win, he could beat you a ball game? You would pitch around him, that meaning pitch to the next hitter, a guy that you know you can get out, or you suspect you can get out a lot better than him. If I don't make a mistake on Reggie, I'm going to get him out. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I'm going to make a mistake. If I do make a mistake, he's going to hit it. Mm-hmm. So let's try somebody else. And that's the way I looked at it.
Bob Gibson, I got to ask you about the 1964 World Series, where you pitched in Game 7 on only 2 days' rest. That's very little rest, after having won Game 5. Took the game all the way into the ninth inning with a 7-3 lead, then gave up 2 homers. And your manager, Johnny Keene, left you in. You finished. You won the game. You were the most valuable player of the series. And afterward, when Johnny Keene asked why he left Gibson in, who seemed to be tired after pitching only 9 innings on only 2 days' rest, he said, I never considered taking him out. I had a commitment to his heart. Tell me about that day and that relationship.
Well, first you got to – I blame Johnny Keene for those last 2 home runs that they hit off of me. I go out, and Johnny says, Bob, I don't want you to get fancy out there. I want you to throw the ball, every pitch, fastball, right over the middle of the plate. He says, I don't think that they're going to hit 4 home runs. And so after the second one, I looked into the dugout, and Johnny was getting a drink of water. I was looking to see, where are you, John? Are you sure they're not going to hit 4? But, you know, I have a commitment to his heart. I can't tell you exactly what he had in mind when he said that. I know that he had plenty of confidence in me. And he felt that he was going to just go down the line with me, win, lose, or draw. Now, that's saying something for him. I didn't want to let him down, period. And I was tired. I was really tired out there. But he was going to leave me in there, so I was going to give it everything I had.
Yeah, I think what he meant was that this man has a will to win like no other.
Yeah, but you keep throwing that fastball over the middle of the plate, mm-hmm. that will might dwindle.
We're speaking with Bob Gibson and Reggie Jackson. They collaborated with Lonnie Wheeler on the new book, 60 Feet, 6 Inches. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Hall of Fame ballplayers Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson. They collaborated with Lonnie Wheeler on a new book called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. I want to talk about throwing inside and guys getting hit by pitches, because you guys have both been on opposite ends of this. And Bob Gibson, with your permission, I'm going to read a section from you from the book that you've collaborated with Reggie here, where you're talking about You're saying basically that you like to pitch on the outside part of the plate, that is the part pitch away from the batter. And you say that nobody's really going to square on a pitch and hit you when you pitch it outside. And then you write, unless he cheats. What I mean is, unless he leans in and dives at that outside corner. Obviously, I can't let him do that because that's where I'm trying to pitch. So if he tries it, I have to stand him up a little bit. Think of the hitter as a dog with an electronic collar. You just administer a slight correction, as they call it, if he tries to get out of his yard. Throw the ball inside, and he can't wander into the wrong area. That's what you were doing when you pitched inside, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I was getting to him to think about the ball inside. Now, Reggie likes to hit the ball out away from him. That's where I want to get him out. So what do I do to keep him from hitting that ball out away from him? I pitch him inside. And I don't just pitch him inside once. I come in there often. And so now he's going to think about me pitching him inside. If he's thinking about that ball inside, then I can get him out of the way. If he's thinking outside and I throw outside, he's more capable of hitting the ball. But if I get inside and do it often enough, he's not going to go leaning out there. Because sometimes when I'm pitching inside and he's thinking outside, you know, the ball comes inside and it'll hit him. So and he knows it. So he says, well, maybe he's going to come in here. More often than not, I'm going to be away from him. But it just might be that one time that I'm not away from him, and he's going to get hurt. It'll come in and bite him.
Well, and a Bob Gibson fastball can hurt you, no doubt. Reggie Jackson, you know, the lore is that pitchers now throw at and throw close to hitters a lot less than they did years ago. I'm wondering, back when you played, how did you feel when a pitcher, you know, knocked you down, threw it in so that you had to jump out of the way? What were the circumstances under which that was okay?
Well, you added something there okay. That's very important. There were circumstances where it was okay. If you hit a good hitter on the other ball club, then somebody on our club was going to get hit, and you know, certain pitchers would make sure they hit either the most important guy, or if you hit the second most important guy over there, you'd hit the second most important guy on our club. And they may just single out and say, okay, we're going to knock Reggie down. Right. We're going to hit him. And you understood it at times, especially if we started and a guy hit a couple of home runs against us, and the pitcher had to hit the guy in order to just get him to respect him a little bit.
Now, that's what's
just can't get abused.
I've got to interrupt you there, because that's one thing that I never did understand. If someone hits two home runs fair and square, is having a great day, that's the reason to throw at him?
Go ahead.
Well, Bob Gibson, let me say this. A guy hitting a home run off of me is not a reason for me to throw at the guy. If the guy hits my best pitch in a good location and he hits a home run, that's a reason for me to throw at him. You know what I mean? I don't want him getting my best pitch. There's a lot of mistakes that I'm going to make. And when I make a mistake, he's capable of hitting a home run. Well, that's my fault. But when he goes out and get my really, really good pitch and hits a home run off it, he might have to get hit the next time.
Now, when you say hit, you're talking about not just coming close. You're talking about drilling him in the ribs?
Hit you in the back.
Well,
the butt.
Yeah, in the ribs or somewhere in there.
Somewhere where it's not bad. If you throw at a guy's head, then we all feel, pitcher as well as hitter, that, you know, you're trying to do some damage or you're messing with my livelihood.
Yeah.
But there are times in baseball when I was coming along, and Bobby too, that you just hit guys, and that was part of the game. There is no question that in the 50s and 60s, black players got thrown at more. That's not a negative comment. It may come out that way, but that's the way it was. Hitting another player was part of the game. Hitting a player in the head is not. When you hit a player in the head, you're more apt to get some fisticuffs or, you know, bring both teams out on the field. But it was more accepted that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I think nowadays it's a little over-policed, because I will always believe that knocking a hitter down, even hitting a hitter at some times, is part of baseball.
Right. And there was this tradition of retaliation, which still happens today, where a pitcher from one team hits a guy on another team, then the batting team's pitcher, when they get back out in the field, will be expected to hit one of their hitters. And then Bob Gibson, that might have put you in the position then sometimes of having to plunk somebody who, because of something that had happened while your team was at bat. How did you feel about that, having to go out there? They call it protecting your team, right?
Yeah, I had no problem with it at all. Now, they used to say, well, wait for the pitcher and get him. I said, no. The pitcher might not even be in the game when you know it's his time to hit. So I would usually, the next inning I pitch, I'd hit the first guy up, and then maybe I would get the best hitter on our team. But I wanted to retaliate so they wouldn't forget, you know, and I just wouldn't wait. And they knew this. The first guy that came up to the plate, he was really in light slippers.
Right.
And nowadays
they promote wait till the right time, wait till you have two outs, wait till you have a lead, and so pick your spot is what it's called.
Well, and umpires will throw you out. They will warn both benches, and then when you hit somebody, you get tossed out, which didn't
work. I don't like that.
I had a situation. It was in San Diego. Lee Wire happened to be the umpire. And we got somebody hit on our ball club, and they knew my reputation as retaliating. You know, and I'm not trying to hurt anybody. I was going to hit them. And after the inning, the half inning was over, and I'm walking to the mound, Lee Wire was walking along with me. Now, Bobby.
So the umpire.
Now, Bobby, if you hit somebody, it's going to cost you $50. It's going to cost you $50. And I said, Lee. And at that time, I was making pretty good money. I said, Lee, I have a whole bunch of $50, so you start adding them up. And he didn't kick me out. First guy up, I didn't hit him. I knocked him down.
Okay.
And he didn't kick me out of the ball.
Sent the message. You know, one thing it's always fascinated me is when ball players get hit, and I know it hurts, they never rub it. What's that about, Reggie Jackson?
Oh, that's not true.
That's not true.
That's not true.
If you get hit and it hurts, I'm going to rub it.
Willie Davis.
I see guys just walk it off, and I don't know how to do it.
Willie Davis was hitting off of me, and my slider was 89, 90 miles an hour. And he swung at a slider of mine, and it hit him in the knee. And he didn't rub it. And I was wondering, I wonder what that's all about. And he hit a ground ball, and he got halfway to first and fell. I said, no, that's more like it. Now I knew. He's got to rub his thing or something.
You know, Reggie Jackson, I know that you were hit in the head a few times and hit once in the face by Doc Ellis. And I'm just wondering, right, after something like that, how do you stand in ever again 60 feet away from a guy that can throw a fastball? Doesn't it affect your nerves?
Well, I went out to the ballpark after I got hit in the head one time, in the face by Doc Ellis, and around 1 o'clock, because I sat out 2 days, and I went out to the ballpark the next day with a big swollen face and almost a closed eye because I was going to play that night. And I had the batting practice pitcher throw at me in batting practice, and I hit for about 45 minutes and got over that. There's another time in Texas, a guy had hit me in the head by the name of Mike Paul, a left-hander for Cleveland. I played against him in college. He hit me in college. And then we got together in the pros. I hit a home run off him in Cleveland. And then about 4 or 5 years later, he was pitching for Texas. And I came up to the plate, and there were two guys on. And the catcher was a kid named Kenny Suarez, who was about 5'7". And I got in the batter's box, and the first pitch that this guy threw to me was up and in. And I turned around to Ken Suarez, and I said, I'm not going to be able to get to the pitcher's mound, but if he hits me, I'm going to rip your face mask off and whoop you right here at home plate. He called time and went to the pitcher's mound. And he looked at the umpire, and the umpire looked at me, and he went to the pitcher's mound and said something to Mike Paul, and the next three pitchers was over in the right-hand hitter's batter's box. I got a walk.
I like that. I like that.
Sending a message. I'm going to fight you.
I think, though, if I had been catching, you and I would have been rolling in the dirt. Oh, yeah.
Reggie Jackson, I have to ask you one thing that I've always wanted to ask a great hitter, and that is, when a pitcher releases the ball, it's on top of you so quickly, and you have a much better chance if you can tell whether it's a fastball or a slider or a curve. Can you actually see the rotation of the ball and tell what kind of pitch it is?
Dave, if you can't see the rotation and tell if it's a sinker, a fastball, then you have to be able to tell whether that fastball is a two-seamer or a four-seamer. You have to be able to recognize if it's a slider or a curveball. You have to be able to recognize if it's a changeup or a split finger. And if you can't, you're not going to be a major league player. You're not going to be a good player. Any other player that's playing every day that's hitting above 275 or 260, he can see what's coming when it leaves the pitcher's hand.
Uh-huh. So that split second, you can pick up the rotation,
yes,
and see what's
coming.
Yes,
you better.
That's amazing.
You better.
That's amazing.
And a guy that with a slider like Bob, you'd see a dot. You'd see a dot in the ball, and you wouldn't yet. You'd see that dot. If that dot got big and you saw it too clear, it was a bad slider, and it was going to leave the ballpark when you swung at it.
You saw a dot. What do you mean by the dot, Reggie?
Just the spin of the baseball with a slider, the rotations and the seams form a dot, a red dot, you know, on the ball as it comes at you,
right,
when it's a real good slider.
Okay.
The guys will say, boy's tight. It's electric. If it got sloppy, the dot got big, and then it became a hanger. It became a bad fastball.
Well, Bob Gibson, Reggie Jackson, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for having us.
Bob, thanks a lot.
Well, you're very welcome.
Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson recorded last fall. Their book is called 60 Feet 6 Inches. You can read the first chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Harriet and Richard Gold, to help extend the breadth and depth of NPR news programming and coverage of global events. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to support America's global competitiveness in a clean energy economy at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, Bruce Weber tells us about calling balls and strikes, when to eject a guy from the game, and what to do if you have to make a call and can't see the play. Weber went to umpire school, officiated games, and interviewed dozens of umps for his book about umpires. And David Edelstein reviews the new film Date Night, starring Tina Fey and Steve Carell. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Baseball's a game where imperfection is the norm. No team wins every game. A pitcher who wins two-thirds of his starts is a star, and a player who can get a hit a third of the time can win a batting title. But there's one guy on the field we expect to perform with perfection every day, the umpire. He has to discern which of 300 pitches thrown at blazing speed are balls and strikes, and make split-second calls on close plays, all the while enduring abuse from players, managers, and especially fans. New York Times writer Bruce Weber says the experience has made umpires an unusually isolated and circumscribed group. like the inhabitants of a remote country few people have ever visited. To understand their world, Weber went to umpiring school himself, called games, and interviewed dozens of present and former umps, as well as players, managers, and baseball executives. The result is his book, As They See 'Em, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. It's now available in paperback. I spoke to Bruce Weber last April when the book was published. Bruce Weber, welcome to Fresh Air. For your journey into the world of umpiring, of course, you talked to lots and lots of umpires, big league, minor league, at all levels, mm-hmm. but you also went to umpiring school, and there you note, learned that a lot of things that look easy and routine to people watching the game actually isn't so easy and routine, and among the simplest things, like taking your mask off. What's hard about that?
Yeah. Well, actually taking it off is not so hard. It's keeping your hat on that's hard. The umpire wears a hat under his mask, and it has a little bill on it, and you have to clear the bill before you pull it off. And there is actually a lesson in umpire school in this. And the reason you have such a lesson is so that you don't end up looking like a jerk when your hat comes off when you're trying to call a play, or if it tips, or you don't want it tipping in your eyes. The umpire is a figure of authority on the field, and he is in such a tough spot most of the time that anything that he does that might bring ridicule upon him is something to be avoided. And that's the whole reason of learning to take your mask off without upsetting your hat.
Right. So for example, ball's hit to left field, you have to jump out in front of the plate or go to a base and be ready to make the call.
Correct.
You pull your mask off, and instead you've got this cap hanging at a cockeyed angle over your eye. Not what you want, right?
Correct. Or if it falls off and lands on the baseline, and you've got this stripe of lime on your hat that you won't be able to get off for the rest of the game.
You know, people who watch the game a lot know that players rotate positions. They know that a pitcher, when a ball is hit to the outfield, will run to back up third or back up home. But I don't know that a lot of people realize that the umpires are doing the same thing, that when there is a play at the plate, it's actually not the home plate umpire making the call. It's the guy from first base because everybody's rotated.
In that particular circumstance, yes. I mean, they don't rotate on every play. The thing that I think most people don't get about umpiring is that learning to be the home plate umpire is in many ways a lot like learning to be a catcher, or learning to be a first base umpire is a lot like learning to be a first baseman. Anytime a ball is hit, anytime there is a play, you have responsibilities. You have to be able to read the play and react with baseball instincts and get to the place that you need to be in order to do what you need to do. It's the same for an umpire as it is for a fielder.
And it doesn't necessarily mean following the ball. It means getting into a position where you will see the play as it unfolds, so you have to anticipate the play, right?
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons that ball players don't necessarily make good umpires is that the instincts turn out to be different. A player's instinct is generally to run towards the ball. You're taught that as a player from, you know, when you first play Little League. But an umpire almost never runs toward the ball as though he's going to make a play on it. He's running toward the place he needs to be in order to make the call. Those are two different things.
Let's take one example. Happens a dozen times in a game. Ground ball to an infielder, third baseman, shortstop.
Right.
They throw across the diamond, and these guys run fast. The batter crosses the base right about the time as the ball gets there. Now, where does that first base umpire need to be to hear and see what he needs to make that call accurately?
If there's nobody on base when the ball is hit, the first base umpire is lined up about along the right field line, about 15 feet behind the first baseman. When the ball is hit to an infielder, he races into the infield and tries to assess from where the throw to first is going to come. And he sets himself up at a 90-degree angle to the anticipated throw, about 15 feet from the bag. At that point, he stares at the bag, listens for the ball hitting in the fielder's glove. That's the chain of events that an umpire goes through.
All right, so when the ball hits the glove, it's either pop, step, as to say, which is
right.
Say he's out, or it's step, pop, in which the runner is safe, right?
Correct.
Right. Right. What happens when an umpire has to make a call, like on the bases, on a base, and they just can't see it, and they're just out of position, and they just don't know?
Well, it happens frequently. Well, maybe I don't want to say it happens frequently. It happens from time to time. You just make the call. You've got a 50% chance of getting it right. You make the call and you sell it as if you had seen it.
And
there really is no alternative, you know. It's and if you blow it, you blow it. But admitting that you can't see it is not an alternative, because once you do that, you've completely lost your authority in the game.
Right.
And
nope.
every decision from then on is open for question.
Nobody's happy then. But
right.
can you look for help? Can you look at another ump and say, did you get it? I mean,
in certain situations you can.
Yeah.
In certain situations, even if you didn't see it, you. Even if you could, you wouldn't. I mean, if it's just say a call at first base, say on a pickoff throw, and you know, you just didn't see it, and everybody's yelling, get some help, get some help, get some help. You won't do it because it. What you're saying is, I didn't do my job. I can't do my job. I need some help. There are certain situations in which there's a legitimate reason for your not being able to see have the proper angle, say on a spectator interference on a foul pop-up or something, in which another umpire might have a better angle, in which case you can ask for help. Or another umpire might say, you know what, I had a better angle, I saw it this way. That does happen from time to time.
When you get behind the plate and have to call balls and strikes, what about just the seeing a ball coming at you at 80 or 90 miles an hour? These guys throw hard, and you're right. You know, you're right in the path of their target.
You do place an awful lot of trust in the catcher, who is, after all, a guy who might not like you very much. And it is something that you need to get over, the fear that you might get hit with the ball. One of the ways in which I was taught this at umpire school was Jim Evans, who ran the school that I attended and was a major league umpire for 28 years, was watching me one day in the cage as I was practicing calling balls and strikes, and he said, you're flinching. You know, I was just calling pitches from a pitching machine, and there was a catcher in front of me, and he wasn't throwing very hard. The machine wasn't throwing very hard, but Jim said, look, you're flinching. The ball's coming in, and you're flinching. Here's how we're going to cure you of that. And he took a basket of baseballs and took me aside. He said, look, you have to learn to trust your equipment. And from a distance of about 4 or 5 feet, he started throwing baseballs at me, hard, hitting me in the mask. Bang, bang, bang. And they were glancing off in all directions. By the time he got to, you know, the 12th or 15th ball, I was beginning to absorb the idea that, you know what, these things are not going to hit me in the eye. I had stopped flinching, and I was cured.
Bruce Weber's book is called As They See 'Em: A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with New York Times reporter Bruce Weber. He's a lifelong baseball fan who's written a book about the world of umpiring. It's called As They See 'Em. In other sports, when a football referee signals a touchdown, it looks like any other football referee signaling a touchdown. His hands go up.
Mm-hmm.
Umpires, you note, each have a signature strike call, a certain way of yelling strike and extending that arm.
Yes.
Is this something they kind of take some pride in and kind of develop and make their own?
I think so. There is such a thing as umpire vanity. I have been in locker rooms where these guys have been practicing their calls in front of a mirror. In the minor leagues especially, they try out different things, and they comment on each other like judges at a at a fashion show. You know, that was you know, I noticed you went to the pistol shot as a strike call. Oh yeah, yeah. How did it look? Yeah, you know, not too bad.
And what's the pistol shot?
The pistol shot is you feign shooting a pistol, bang, with you know, you shoot out your right hand from the elbow with a finger pointing out, bang.
Right, and then the sounds aren't uniform either. Each has their own way of calling a strike, right?
That's right.
Now I'm gonna. I don't know if you feel comfortable doing this, but could I ask you to like maybe back off the mic just a little bit and give us your strike call?
Sure, sure.
All right, now let's say it's a third strike. Curveball drops in, and the batter freezes. He's out. Oh yeah, that takes me to the ballpark. All right, let me do one more. Now you're on the bases. There's a runner breaks for second. It's a steal. That's a very close play. You call him out. What does it sound like?
Out.
And what are you doing while you're saying that?
Pumping down with my fist at the runner. And yeah, you pump when it's a really close play. When it's a really close play, you want to be demonstrative because you want to sell the call. You want to let everybody know, look, I know it was a close play, but I saw it. Don't argue with me.
Right. And then maybe you turn on your heel and walk away, right?
Exactly.
Except when somebody argues. And that brings up a whole other great subject in baseball. You know, it's the one game where, except for on balls and strikes, you're allowed to run onto the field and get in the umpire's face.
Yeah, it's the only sport where non-participants are actually allowed on the field to play.
Did they teach you in umpire's school how to handle an argument? And
oh yeah, I mean it's very much a part of umpire school. In fact, there's a whole kind of slice of umpire school that reminds me of acting school. One of the things that they set up plays for you that are virtually impossible to call. That no matter what you call, there's going to be an argument. So. You'll make the call, and one of the instructors posing as a manager or coach will come on the field to object to the call. The idea is they want to see how you, as an umpire, are going to handle this kind of situation, which happens all the time in the in both the minor leagues and the major leagues. And these instructors are generally using the kinds of arguments that they themselves hear because they themselves are. Minor league umpires.
Yeah, it's angry and profane, I assume. Now,
it is, and manipulative, and if you're going to make that kind of call, you're going to die here in single A. You think you're going to get promoted? Forget it. You can't make a call like that. That kind of stuff.
And how are you taught to respond? I mean, what's a good way of handling the ump's end of an argument?
Well, the thing about umpires and arguments is that an umpire goes against his instincts as a human being. Most people, they get in an argument and they try to win it. But an umpire's job is not to win the argument, it's to end the argument. If the guy just wants to come out and yell and scream, you fold your arms and you let him yell and scream a little bit, and then you say, okay, you've had your say, that's enough. If he keeps going, you sort of have to read your opponent. If he starts kicking dirt on you, well, get off the dirt and onto the grass where there isn't any dirt to kick. If he wants to go nose to nose with you and start yelling and screaming, don't let him do it if he's chewing tobacco. Don't let him get the bill of his cap underneath the bill of yours, because as he bobs his head, he'll be knocking you in the forehead with it. I mean, these are, and in the end, don't do things like bait him. Don't try to get the last word in. Don't insult him. Don't do anything that is going to perpetuate the argument. Now, this is all easier said than done. When a guy is calling your mother all kinds of different names and questioning your ethnicity and your heritage and your manhood and all of the other really important issues that come up in an argument like that, it's kind of hard to keep your head and remember that. That really what you and forget that what you really want to do is punch this guy in the nose.
Well, just as arguing is part of the game, so is tossing a manager or a player out of the game. And I'm sure they also gave you practice at ejecting somebody. How do you know when to give somebody the heave-ho?
Well, there are there are certain guidelines for this. There are certain explicit guidelines. In fact, there are 13 explicit reasons that you are allowed to throw somebody out of the game, and you know some of them are pretty self-evident. I mean, if somebody throws equipment out of the dugout, if you slam your helmet down in evident displeasure with an umpire's call, if you make contact with an umpire or spit at an umpire, those sorts of things.
Now, what about profanity? I mean, can they?
Well, you can use all the profanity you want as long as you don't make it personal. You know, it's as one umpire said to me: people always want to know what the magic word is. Is it, you know, is it horse bleep? Is it mother bleep? And no, it's not. It's, you know, it's none of those words. The magic word is you. So you can say that was a horse bleep call, but you can't say your horse bleep.
Okay.
And when, if you know what I mean, I'm speaking
in code. No, it's clear.
No,
it's code. Right. It's the ad hominem attack that will get you run, as they say. That's why I run him. You'll hear that expression.
That's right.
And what's the right way to run somebody to get him out of the game?
As demonstratively and authoritatively as possible. You know, you're taught to throw your right arm over your head and say something like, "You're out of here," or "That's it, you're done," or "Enough, goodbye," something like that.
Yelling at the ballpark is a part of the tradition of going to a ball game. Can you think of some of the more memorable things you've heard from hecklers of umpires?
Well, let's see. You know, the problem is most of them are most of them are dirty.
Well, if you can clean them up, then do so. And if we can't, you know, then it'll be our little secret.
You know, bend over and use your good eye.
Oh, gosh. Right.
Usually it's that level. But to be honest with you, most of the and this is, I think, one of the great shames of baseball. And baseball fans should be ashamed of themselves for this, which is that the imagination of the fans and their abuse of the umpires is sorely lacking. I mean, it's mostly just, "Hey, poke a hole in the mask," or "You're blind, you bum," or "You stink." One of the things that umpires say is that they never hear it anymore because they've heard everything 10,000 times, and that they only notice when they've heard something that that they haven't heard before, which is only maybe once or twice a season.
Well, Bruce Weber, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Bruce Weber's book about the world of umpiring is called As They See 'Em. Here's a memorable argument on the diamond from the film Bull Durham. Catcher Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, thinks the ump has missed a call at home plate.
Hey! No! Oh, my God! I missed it! I didn't miss it!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus! Hey. He still ain't touched the plate! Oh, the call!
You call me a
You can't throw me for that. You missed the tag. You just spit on me.
I did not spit,
you
spit on you.
You spit on me.
I did not spit on you.
Oh, you're in the wrong business, Jack.
Oh, yeah.
You're Susan Roper.
Yeah, right.
Criteria.
You're pushing it, buddy. You're pushing it. You want me to run you? I'll run you.
Well, you want me to call you a
try.
You want me to
try
call
it. Me a
pretty please.
And you're out.
Pretty please.
Call me a and you're out of here.
You're a
you're out of here. What the is that?
Kevin Costner bringing it in the classic baseball film Bull Durham. You can read the first chapter of Bruce Weber's book As They See Him on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Edelstein on Date Night, the new film with Tina Fey and Steve Carell. This is Fresh Air. Sitcom fans will be excited to see that two TV superstars, Steve Carell and Tina Fey, are on the big screen in a new romantic action comedy called Date Night. Film critic David Edelstein says they haven't brought their sophisticated brand of comedy along with them.
One of the funniest things in Date Night isn't actually in Date Night, but on one of the movie's several posters. Tina Fey is in her gauzy, purplish party dress, spattered with mud, her hair all splayed out. But with her right hand, she's smoothing the ends in a cool, sexy way. That pose gives a hint of Fey's brilliance. It's the teensy neurotic, or maybe obsessive-compulsive, gesture that's totally at odds with what's happening in the moment. She's not just a gifted mimic. As she proved in her Sarah Palin impersonations, Fey grasps the continuum between her character's vanity and insanity. The movies haven't done her justice. But then, movies are increasingly the lesser medium for comic actors like Fey and her Date Night co-star Steve Carell. They're the stars of two network sitcoms that have moved the boundary posts. Yet their comedies on the big screen are bloated and generic. You see them working too hard to be funny, doing broad shtick that's only tangentially related to the characters they're playing. The premise of Date Night is perfectly serviceable, classic even. It's the old North by Northwest mistaken identity nightmare. A New Jersey couple named Phil and Claire Foster fear their domestic life has become stale and wearying and decide to hit the town and rekindle their youthful passion. But they overreach. They get in way over their heads. At a super trendy Manhattan restaurant where they don't have a prayer of getting a table, Phil takes another couple's reservation when that couple doesn't answer the hostess's page. They have such a great meal and so much good wine that they almost don't mind when two men they think work for the restaurant order them to leave the table and bring them out to the alley.
I want to talk to your boss right now.
I think we both know that's not gonna happen, Mr. Triplehorn. Or should I say, Phil Foster.
Next time you make a dinner reservation, don't use the same alias as your ransom notes, genius.
Let me explain. My husband, very sweetly but delusionally, thought that we could make it here early enough to get a table, and right. We didn't. We were late,
they
and
were
when
so
we
rude, that
heard
one guy...
them calling the reservation for Triplehorns, he was like, us, and
that's...
so we took it.
So you just took somebody else's reservation?
For the record, I was against it. But my husband gets these plans in his head, and it becomes like a thing.
I'm an idiot.
Even with material this uninspired, Fey and Carell have style and aplomb. Carell has a good frozen deadpan. He's often funnier when he's just about to speak than when he finally gets the words out. When the camera sits back and just watches them, their rhythms are rather exquisite. So are their scenes with Mark Wahlberg as an old real estate client of Claire's who helps them figure out who's hunting them. Wahlberg is shirtless and so pumped up that his trapezoid muscles have their own trapezoid muscles, and Fey stares at him and babbles away, glassy-eyed, while Carell stares at him with so much shame at his own puny status he can barely speak. But Date Night is not a movie that honors exquisite rhythms. It's a movie that calls for big, whacking hysteria and dumb slapstick and car chases. The director, Sean Levy, made Night at the Museum and its sequel and the Steve Martin remakes of The Pink Panther and Cheaper by the Dozen. He's considered one of Hollywood's top comedy directors, probably because he bashes things along so that kids have a good time and parents don't get bored. But he's a comedy killer. Even potentially great bits, when Carell and Fey pretend to be a pimp and a prostitute and perform the nerdiest pole dance in film history, don't build and pay off. The supporting actors who have to carry the plot, something to do with a corrupt DA and a blackmailing gangster, which is lazy and slapdash even by dumb comedy standards, look marooned. There are great TV comedians who push the envelope on screen. Ricky Gervais, who created the role on The Office that Steve Carell Americanized, made the daringly irreverent The Invention of Lying. Will Ferrell hit dizzying slapstick heights in Step Brothers. I'm not sure Carell and Fey are in their league, but if they keep working in vehicles like this, how will we ever know?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. We're ending today's show with music from jazz pianist John Bunch, who died last week at the age of 88. His graceful playing and elegant touch was grounded both in the swing era and in bebop. As jazz critic Ira Gittler wrote, "There are ways to swing at virtually any tempo, and Bunch knows them all." Join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of digital media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Peter Wolf on his life and music career, including fronting the Jay Giles Band and getting to know some iconic blues musicians.
James Cotton would cook up all sorts of chicken, and Muddy would tell Howlin' Wolf, hey, you know, there's this young guy has an apartment, so he would come by. Johnny Hooker would come by, and they would just all hang.
Wolf has a new solo CD. Join us.